A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about VLAN tagging on home and small business networks, specifically when you're bringing your own hardware to an ISP connection instead of using their provided router. The core question is, if you need to set a specific VLAN tag to make the connection work, does that mean you're tagging your traffic so the WAN site can see it? Why is this even necessary? And what are the common ways authentication falls apart when you're plugging your own gear into ISP-managed fiber? There's a lot to unpack here, because this isn't just a configuration checkbox. It's a window into how ISPs actually architect their networks.
The first thing to understand, most people get this backwards, is that the VLAN tag isn't about making your traffic visible to the WAN. It's the opposite. The ISP is running multiple services over the same physical fiber strand, and the VLAN tag is how they separate internet traffic from IPTV, from voice, from management traffic, all on that one strand coming into your home. When you tag your WAN interface with VLAN, say 10 or 35 or whatever your ISP specifies, you're not announcing yourself. You're tuning to the right channel.
Tuning to the right channel. So it's less like putting your name on your mailbox, and more like selecting which wire inside the cable you're actually talking on.
Exactly the mental model. The physical fiber coming into your ONT or your SFP module, that's the cable. The VLANs are the virtual wires inside it. Your ISP might be running VLAN 100 for internet, VLAN 200 for their managed TV service, VLAN 300 for voice. If you plug in your own router and don't tag the WAN interface, you're essentially yelling into an empty channel that nobody's listening on.
Which explains why the ISP-provided router just works out of the box, and yours doesn't. It's pre-configured to know which channel to listen on.
And this is the part that trips people up conceptually. When we think about VLANs in our own networks, say you've got a management VLAN for your switches, a guest VLAN, a mainLAN VLAN, you're the one defining the segmentation. You create VLAN 20, you assign ports, you're in control. In the ISP scenario, you're not defining anything. You're conforming to their existing segmentation. The VLAN ID is assigned to you by the network operator. You're joining their architecture.
The tag doesn't cross the WAN boundary into the broader internet. It's stripped at the ISP's first aggregation point.
Stripped at the OLT, the optical line terminal, or at the BNG, the broadband network gateway, depending on the architecture. By the time your traffic hits the actual internet, the VLAN header is long gone. It's purely a layer 2 access mechanism between your equipment and the ISP's first real routing hop.
Which makes the original question almost a category error. You're not tagging for the WAN to see you. You're tagging so the ISP's access layer even knows what to do with your frames.
That's the cleanest way to put it. And this is where I want to dig into the architecture, because there are actually two very different scenarios where this shows up, and they get conflated constantly in forum posts and Reddit threads.
Let's hear them. Let's hear them.
Scenario one is fiber to the home with an ONT. That's the little box the ISP installs that converts optical to copper Ethernet. In that setup, the ONT is usually doing the VLAN tagging for you. You plug your router into the ONT's Ethernet port, you get plain untagged DHCP, and you never think about VLANs. Scenario 2 is where you've eliminated the ONT entirely, and you're plugging the fiber directly into your own equipment, an SFP module in your router or switch. That's where the VLAN tag becomes your responsibility, because now your device has to do what the ONT used to do.
The ONT was the translator, and you fired the translator.
You fired the translator, and now you're standing in a country where you don't speak the language holding a phrasebook. The VLAN tag is the first phrase you need.
For the small business side of this, same logic? Just more VLANs?
Often more, yes. A small business fiber connection might have a dedicated voice. VLAN, a data VLAN, maybe a management VLAN the ISP uses to monitor link quality. But the principle is identical. The ISP dictates the VLAN IDs, and you match them on your equipment's WAN interfaces.
Let's get into the why. Why did ISPs architect things this way? Because from a user perspective, it feels like an unnecessary hurdle. Plug in, get internet. Why the extra step?
It goes back to the early 2000s and the triple play push. Phone companies and cable operators were all trying to sell you internet plus TV plus voice over a single connection. VLAN segmentation let them deliver all three services over one physical link without them interfering with each other. Internet traffic on one VLAN, multicast video on another, voice on a third with quality of service guarantees. Once that infrastructure was built out, it became the standard even for internet-only customers, because it's simpler to manage one architecture for everyone.
We're living with the architectural decisions of the triple play era, even if we're just buying internet.
And it's not just legacy inertia. There are real operational reasons to keep it. VLANs let the ISP isolate customer traffic at layer 2. They can apply per VLAN rate limiting. They can separate management traffic from customer traffic. They can run DHCP and authentication services that only listen on specific VLANs. If everyone were just sending untagged frames into the access network, the ISP loses a lot of control over what's happening at the edge.
Which brings us to the authentication failure modes, which is where this gets genuinely interesting, and where I've seen people lose entire weekends.
Oh, the weekend destroying failure modes. Let me count the ways. The most common one, and the one that's hardest to diagnose because it produces no useful error messages, is VLAN mismatch. You tag your WAN interface with the wrong VLAN ID, and from your perspective, everything looks configured correctly. Interface is up, link light is on, but no DHCP lease ever arrives. You're sending DHCP discover packets into a VLAN where no DHCP server is listening.
The digital equivalent of knocking on the wrong door and wondering why nobody answers.
The link light is the cruelest part of this. Link light means layer 1 is fine. The physical connection is solid. Your SFP module has sync. The fiber is good. But layer 2 is silently broken, and most consumer router interfaces give you zero visibility into whether your tagged frames are actually reaching anything.
What's the first diagnostic step?
If you have a router that can do packet captures on the WAN interface, something like OpenSense or PFSense or MikroTik Router OS, you run a capture and look for any incoming traffic at all. If you see absolutely nothing, no ARP requests, no DHCP offers, no broadcast traffic, you're either on the wrong VLAN or there's an authentication layer you haven't crossed yet. If you see some traffic but no DHCP, that's a different problem.
What are the other common failures?
MAC address locking is a big one. Some ISPs, especially fiber providers using GPON infrastructure, bind your service to the MAC address of the ONT or the router they originally installed. When you swap in your own equipment, the OLT sees a different MAC and refuses to forward traffic. The symptom is identical to VLAN mismatch, dead silence on the wire, but the fix is completely different. You either need to clone the original MAC address onto your new router's WAN interface, or call the ISP and have them clear the binding.
Good luck getting the Tier 1 support person to understand what you're asking for.
The conversation usually goes, "I need you to clear my MAC binding." Sir, have you tried restarting your router? Yes, 3 times. I'm using my own equipment. The MAC address changed. Sir, we don't support third-party routers.
Of course they don't, which is both a technical limitation and a policy choice.
It's a policy choice dressed as a technical limitation. The GPON standard supports new MAC addresses just fine. The OLT can be configured to allow them. But many ISPs lock it down because it reduces their support burden and makes it harder for customers to do exactly what we're describing.
VLAN mismatch and MAC locking are the two big ones. What about authentication protocols?
This is where it gets more complex. Depending on the ISP in the country, you might be dealing with PPPoE, IPoE with DHCP options, or 802.1x certificate-based authentication. PPPoE is still surprisingly common on fiber networks, especially in Europe and parts of Asia. You need a username and password in addition to the correct VLAN tag. The failure mode there is usually a timeout. Your router sends PADI packets, the PPPoE discovery initiation, and either gets no response or gets a PADO from the wrong access concentrator.
PADI and PADO. For listeners who haven't had the pleasure, these are the hello, is anyone there? And yes, I'm here of PPPoE.
PADI is the client saying, are there any PPPoE servers out there? PADO is the server saying, yes, I'm here, here's my name. If your VLAN is wrong, your PADI goes into the void. If your VLAN is right, but your credentials are wrong, you get a PADO, but then the session setup fails. And if there are multiple access concentrators on the same VLAN, which happens when ISPs have redundant infrastructure, your router might pick the wrong one.
IPOE. IP over Ethernet. That's the DHCP-based approach.
Right, and it's becoming more common as ISPs move away from the complexity of PPPoE. With IPOE, you tag the correct VLAN, your router sends a DHCP discover, and you get an IP address. But the failure modes are sneakier. Some ISPs require specific DHCP options. Option 60 for vendor class identifier, option 61 for client identifier, option 77 for user class. If your router isn't sending the right values in those options, the DHCP server ignores your request. You get nothing, with no indication of why.
It's not just tag VLAN 10 and you're good. It's tag VLAN 10, send the right DHCP options, and maybe clone a MAC address, and maybe also handle PPPoE credentials.
This is exactly why the ISP-provided router exists. It's pre-configured with all of this. The ISP knows exactly what VLANs, what authentication method, what DHCP options, what MAC address range. They ship a box that does all of it. When you BYOD, bring your own device, you're reverse engineering their assumptions.
Let's talk about the actual VLAN IDs for a moment. Is there any standardization here, or is it the Wild West?
It's mostly the Wild West, with a few de facto conventions. Many European ISPs use VLAN 10 for internet. Deutsche Telekom uses VLAN 7, some use VLAN 35 or VLAN 100. In the US, AT&T Fiber uses VLAN 0, which is technically the untagged VLAN but with specific 802.1Q priority bits set. Verizon FiOS doesn't use VLAN tagging at all for internet in many regions, just untagged DHCP. But then if you have FiOS TV, the set-top boxes use a separate VLAN for multicast video.
There's no lookup table. You're dependent on forum posts from other customers who figured it out.
The quality of those forum posts varies wildly. One person says VLAN 10, another says VLAN 100, and they're both right because they're on different regional infrastructure from the same ISP. Or the ISP changed their VLAN scheme 3 years ago, and the old forum posts are still the top Google results.
The archaeology of internet configuration.
That's actually a perfect way to describe it. You're doing archaeological digging through five-year-old DSLR reports threads, trying to find someone with the same ISP, same region, same plan, who successfully got their own router working.
I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, 802.1x certificate authentication. That's a whole other layer.
It's increasingly common on business fiber connections and some residential deployments. The ISP installs a certificate on their router, and the network authenticates the device based on that certificate. If you want to use your own hardware, you need to extract that certificate from the ISP router, which is often deliberately difficult, or get the ISP to provision a certificate for your device, which they usually won't do for residential customers.
Extract the certificate. That sounds like a cryptographic heist.
It effectively is. People have done it. There are guides for extracting certificates from certain ISP router models by dumping the flash memory or by exploiting vulnerabilities in the router's firmware. But it's not something most users should be attempting, and it raises some interesting legal questions about whether you're violating the ISP's terms of service or even computer fraud laws.
For the average person who just wants to use their own router, there's a practical ceiling on how BYOD-friendly an ISP is.
And that ceiling is set by the authentication method. If the ISP uses simple DHCP on a known VLAN with no MAC locking, you're golden, plug in your router, set the VLAN, done. If they use PPPoE with publicly documented credentials, still very doable. If they use DHCP with obscure option requirements, harder but figure outable. If they use 802.1x with device certificates, you're probably better off putting their router in bridge mode and calling it a day.
Bridge mode, the negotiated surrender.
Sometimes the negotiated surrender is the smartest move. You keep their router as a modem/authenticator, you disable its routing and Wi-Fi, and you hang your own router off it. You get your preferred network equipment, they handle the authentication. It's not as clean as a direct fiber connection, but it works.
Let's get into some specific examples. What are the ISPs that are notably difficult for BYOD?
AT&T Fiber in the US is the classic example. Their residential gateways use 802.1x certificate authentication, and for years the only way to bypass their router was a complicated setup involving a managed switch that would strip VLAN zero tags and forward the authentication traffic. There's a whole community around the AT&T bypass, people running custom configurations on Ubiquiti and MikroTik gear to eliminate the AT&T gateway entirely.
A whole community. So this isn't just a handful of nerds in a basement.
It's thousands of people. The current approach for many is to use the WPA A-supplicant package on a Linux-based router to handle the 802.1x authentication, presenting the extracted certificates from the AT&T gateway. It's technically impressive, but fragile. An AT&T firmware update can break it.
On the other end of the spectrum, who's BYOD friendly?
Many municipal fiber networks and smaller regional ISPs are great about this. They'll tell you the VLAN ID and the authentication method. Some of them use straight DHCP with no authentication at all. Just tag the right VLAN and you're online. In Europe, ISPs like KPN in the Netherlands and several of the Scandinavian providers are reasonably friendly to customer-owned equipment, but it varies enormously by country and by provider.
I want to talk about the small business side, because the prompt specifically asked about that. Is the situation different for a small business fiber connection?
It can be, and not always in the direction you'd expect. Small business connections sometimes use the exact same infrastructure as residential. Same OLT, same VLAN scheme, same authentication. But the SLA is different, the support tier is different, and the ISP might be more willing to document what you need for your own equipment. In other cases, business fiber is a completely separate architecture. Dedicated fiber, not GPON, with a direct point-to-point connection to the ISP's aggregation router. In those setups, VLAN tagging might not be required at all because you're not sharing the fiber with other customers.
Dedicated fiber. That's the dream, but the price tag is usually an order of magnitude higher.
Easily 10 times the cost for a dedicated fiber drop versus a GPON connection. For most small businesses, GPON with a business SLA is the sweet spot. You're still on shared infrastructure, but you get better support and usually more static IP options.
Let's get practical for a moment. If someone's listening and they're about to attempt this, plugging their own router into an ISP fiber connection, what's the checklist?
Step 1. Research before you buy anything. Find out what your ISP actually requires. Step 2. Identify whether you have an ONT or whether you're connecting fiber directly. If there's an ONT, you probably don't need to worry about VLANs. The ONT handles it. Step 3. If you're going direct fiber, find the VLAN ID from community sources or ISP documentation. Step 4. Determine the authentication method, DHCP, PPP, PPPoE, or 802.1x. Step 5. Check if there's MAC address locking. Step 6. Configure your router, connect, and be prepared for it not to work the first time.
Step 7. Don't do this on a Sunday night when you need internet for work on Monday morning.
That's the voice of experience speaking.
I have never made that mistake. I have watched someone very close to me make that mistake.
I resemble that remark. But seriously, the time factor is real. These configurations can take hours of trial and error. And if you're dependent on forum posts and packet captures to diagnose what's wrong, you don't want to be racing a deadline.
What about the hardware side? Does the choice of router matter for this?
Consumer all-in-one routers from companies like Netgear or TP-Link often have limited VLAN support on the WAN side. They might support VLAN tagging for IPTV, but not for the internet connection itself. Or the VLAN configuration is buried in a menu that's only accessible through a specific firmware version. If you're serious about BYOD on fiber, you want a router that gives you full control over the WAN interface. OPNSense, PFSense, OpenRouti, MikroTik, Router OS, or Ubiquiti's Edge Router line.
Those have a learning curve.
But they also have communities and documentation. If you search OPNSense with insert ISP here fiber, you're likely to find a step-by-step guide. That's harder to find for a random consumer router.
Let's talk about a failure mode we haven't mentioned yet. MTU issues.
Oh, that's a subtle one. VLAN tagging adds 4 bytes to the Ethernet frame. If your ISP is using standard 1500 byte MTU, but your router is sending 1500 byte frames and then adding a 4 byte VLAN tag, you're now sending 1504 byte frames. If the ISP's infrastructure doesn't handle that gracefully, and GPON equipment sometimes doesn't, you get fragmentation, packet loss, or connections that work for small packets but hang on large ones.
The classic, I can ping but I can't load web pages symptom.
The fix is to set your WAN interface MTU to 1492 or 1496, accounting for the VLAN tag overhead. Some ISPs use baby jumbo frames and support 1508 or higher on the WAN side, but you can't assume that. It's another thing you discover through trial and error or through someone else's forum post.
It's the kind of problem that's maddening to diagnose because it's intermittent and content dependent. Some websites load fine because their assets are small. Others break mysteriously.
You end up in the wrong diagnostic rabbit hole. You're checking DNS, you're checking routing, you're rebooting equipment, and the whole time it's 4 bytes of frame overhead causing the problem.
The 4 bytes of doom.
A haiku waiting to be written.
I want to shift gears slightly and talk about the security implications of all this. If you're tagging your traffic onto a specific VLAN on the ISP's access network, what's the isolation model? Can other customers on the same GPON split see your traffic?
This is a common concern and mostly a misconception. On a GPON network, the downstream traffic from the OLT to the ONTs is broadcast to all ONTs on the same split, but it's encrypted with AES at the GPON layer. Each ONT has its own encryption key established during the registration process. So in theory, other customers on the same split can't decrypt your traffic. In practice, the encryption is only as good as the key management, and GPON encryption has been criticized for weaknesses. But exploiting those requires physical access to the fiber and specialized equipment.
It's not like an old-school Ethernet hub where everyone sees everyone's packets.
It's not. The bigger security concern isn't other customers on the same split, it's the ISP's own infrastructure. When you're on their VLAN, your traffic passes through their switches and routers before it hits the internet. If the ISP has misconfigured their layer 2 isolation, and this happens, customers on the same VLAN but different physical segments could potentially see each other's broadcast traffic.
Which is why you should be running your own firewall regardless.
The ISP's VLAN is not your trusted network. Treat the WAN interface as hostile, same as you would any internet connection. The fact that it's a VLAN on a fiber doesn't change the threat model.
What about the ISP's perspective? Why do they care so much about which router you use? Beyond the support burden argument.
A few reasons, some legitimate, some less so. The legitimate one is network stability. A misconfigured customer router can cause problems beyond that customer's connection. Broadcasting excessive DHCP requests, creating loops if someone bridges interfaces incorrectly, generating malformed frames. The ISP router is a known quantity they've tested against their infrastructure.
The less legitimate reasons.
Data collection and service bundling. The ISP router often has built-in analytics, what devices are connected, how much bandwidth each uses when the network is active. Some ISPs use their routers to provide a public Wi-Fi hotspot that other customers can use, running on a separate VLAN from your private traffic. And of course, the router is a vector for upselling. Your router can't handle these speeds. You need our new mesh system for only $9.99 a month.
The router as a recurring revenue platform.
It's the printer ink model applied to networking. Give away the hardware, lock in the service. And if you use your own equipment, you're breaking that model.
Which is why the BYOD hostility isn't just technical inertia, it's a business decision.
When an ISP makes it difficult to use your own router, they're not just being technically conservative, they're protecting a revenue stream and a data collection pipeline.
Let's get into one more technical detail. The difference between tagged and untagged on the WAN port, because this confuses people who are used to configuring VLANs on their LAN side.
This is a great point. On your LAN, you typically have a management interface, the router's web UI, or SSH, that's accessible on the untagged VLAN. Then you create tagged VLANs for different subnets. On the WAN side, it's conceptually different. You're not creating VLANs, you're joining one. Your WAN interface is a client on the ISP's VLAN. You tag your outgoing traffic with their VLAN ID so their switches know where to forward it.
The mental model is flipped. On the LAN, you're the network operator defining the VLANs. On the WAN, you're a tenant in someone else's VLAN architecture.
That's the cleanest way to think about it. You're a tenant. You get assigned a VLAN ID, and you use it. You don't get to create new ones or change the numbering scheme or decide what's tagged and what's untagged.
I'm thinking about the small business scenario again. If a business has multiple static IPs from their ISP, say a block of 8, how does that interact with the VLAN setup?
Usually, the ISP routes the entire block to your connection. Your router gets one IP via DHCP or static assignment on the WAN interface, and the additional IPs are routed to that address. You then configure those IPs as aliases on your WAN interface or as one-to-one NAT mappings to internal servers. The VLAN configuration doesn't change, it's still just the one tag. The IP routing happens at layer 3, on top of the layer 2 VLAN.
The VLAN is just the delivery mechanism. Everything else is layered on top.
And that's worth emphasizing because people sometimes think they need multiple VLANs for multiple IPs. You don't. The VLAN is the access circuit. What you do with the IP space above it is separate.
What about IPv6 in these setups? Does VLAN tagging interact with prefix delegation?
It shouldn't, but it can. Some ISPs use separate VLANs for IPv4 and IPv6. I've seen this on a few European providers. More commonly, both run over the same VLAN, and your router gets an IPv4 address via DHCP and an IPv6 prefix via DHCPv6 prefix delegation on the same tagged interface. The failure mode is when the ISP's DHCPv6 server is configured differently from their DHCPv4 server, different option requirements, different timing, and you get an IPv4 address but no IPv6 prefix, or vice versa.
The dual stack partial failure. You're online, but only half online.
It's hard to notice at first because most things fall back to IPv4. You might go weeks without realizing your IPv6 isn't working until you try to access something that's IPv6 only or you run an IPv6 connectivity test.
The checklist we mentioned earlier should include verify both address families
and check your prefix delegation size. Some ISPs hand out a /64, some a /56, some a /48. If your router is requesting a different prefix size than what the ISP is configured to give, the delegation can fail silently.
I want to come back to something you said earlier about the triple play origins of all this. It strikes me that we're in this weird transitional moment where the original use case for ISP VLAN segmentation is fading. Who's buying IPTV and voice from their fiber provider anymore? But the architecture persists because it's embedded.
It's path dependency and networking. The architecture was built for a world where everyone had a set-top box and a home phone. That world is mostly gone, but the VLAN scheme is baked into the OLTs, the provisioning systems, the support documentation, the training for the field techs. Changing it would be a multi-year, multi-billion-dollar effort across hundreds of ISPs. So we live with VLAN 10 and VLAN 35 and PPPoE credentials, not because they're the best solution for 2026, but because they were the best solution for 2005.
The new entrants, the municipal fiber networks, the community broadband projects, they're the ones who get to start fresh with a simpler architecture.
They often do. Straight DHCP, no VLAN tagging for internet, no PPPoE, no MAC locking. Just plug in and go. It's a competitive advantage in user experience that the incumbents can't match without rebuilding their access networks.
Which they won't do unless the market forces them to.
The market won't force them to because most customers don't choose their ISP based on whether they can use their own router. It's maybe the 15th factor on the list, after price, speed, reliability, and whether the ISP's ads have a friendly cartoon character.
The friendly cartoon character is a surprisingly effective marketing strategy.
I'm not saying I've chosen ISPs based on mascots. I'm also not saying I haven't.
Let's go deeper on one specific technical scenario that's coming up more often. The SFP-based direct fiber connection. Someone buys a router with an SFP cage, gets the right SFP module for their ISP's fiber type, plugs it in. What's the first thing that happens at layer 2?
The SFP module establishes link. That's the easy part. Then your router's interface comes up and starts sending frames. If you haven't configured a VLAN tag, those frames are untagged. The OLT receives them and has no idea what to do with them because it's expecting tagged frames on a specific VLAN. The frames get dropped. Your router shows link up but no traffic. This is the most common first attempt failure.
You set the VLAN tag.
Now your tagged frames reach the OLT, which recognizes the VLAN and forwards them to the appropriate upstream interface. Depending on the ISP's architecture, that upstream interface might be connected to a BNG that handles authentication and IP assignment, or it might go through an aggregation switch first. Either way, your DHCP Discover, or PPPoE PADI, now reaches a server that can respond.
If the ISP uses DHCP with option requirements, your router needs to send the right options in that Discover packet.
And here's where the router software matters. Some routers let you specify arbitrary DHCP options on the WAN interface. Some don't. If your ISP requires option 60 with a specific vendor class string, something like MISP Fiber ERSA-C, and your router doesn't let you set that, you're stuck. You'll see DHCP offers going to other customers, but not to you.
Can you capture other customers' DHCP traffic to see what options they're sending?
On a properly configured GPO network, no, the downstream encryption prevents it. But on some older or misconfigured networks, yes, and people have done exactly that to reverse engineer the required options. It's a gray area ethically and potentially legally, but it's technically possible.
The lengths people go to.
The desire to use your own router is powerful. It's about control, privacy, performance, and to some extent principle. You're paying for the connection. You should be able to choose what equipment terminates it.
There's a broader point here about the demarcation point. In the old DSL days, the demarc was clear. The phone line entered your house. You plugged in your own modem if you wanted. With fiber, the ISP often claims the ONT or the router as part of their network, extending their control past the physical entry point into your home.
That's a regulatory question as much as a technical one. The FCC has rules about customer premises equipment and the right to attach your own devices, but they're unevenly enforced and they vary by technology. Fiber is newer territory than copper, and the rules haven't fully caught up.
When someone's struggling to get their own router working on a fiber connection, they're not just fighting a configuration problem. They're fighting a structural tension between the ISP's desire for control and the user's desire for autonomy.
That's the deeper layer of this whole discussion. Every VLAN tag you configure is a small act of sovereignty over your own network.
Every MAC address you clone is a small act of deception.
Deception in service of sovereignty. I can live with that.
Let's learn some practical guidance before we wrap up. Someone's about to attempt this. They've got their router. They've got their ISP's fiber. What's the one piece of advice that would save them the most time?
Find the community first. Before you touch a single configuration setting, find the forum thread, the Reddit post, the wiki page where someone with your exact ISP and your exact plan has documented what worked. The information is almost certainly out there. Don't start from scratch.
If the information isn't out there,
then you're doing original research and you should document what you find for the next person. But also, consider whether this is actually worth your time. Bridge mode exists for a reason.
The negotiated surrender. We're back to that.
Sometimes surrender is the victory. You get your own router, your own Wi-Fi, your own firewall rules, your own DNS. The ISP's box becomes a dumb modem. That's still a win.
If you absolutely must have the clean direct fiber connection, no ISP box at all, be prepared for it to be a project, not a quick configuration change. Budget a weekend. Have a backup internet connection for research.
Just because you got an IP address doesn't mean everything works. Check MTU-sensitive applications, large file downloads, VPN connections. Run speed tests in both directions. Let it run for a day before you declare victory.
The it works to it actually works gap,
which can be surprisingly wide. I've seen setups where everything looked fine for basic browsing, but fell apart on video calls because of MTU fragmentation on UDP traffic. That's the kind of thing you only catch with real-world use.
This has been a proper deep dive into something that seems like a small configuration detail, but turns out to be a window into ISP architecture, business models, and the quiet tension between network operators and the people who just want to use their own router.
It's one of those topics where the more you dig, the more you realize how much is going on behind a single configuration field labeled VLAN ID.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In 1912, a German colonial administrator stationed in what is now Namibia compiled a manuscript on indigenous sports of the region. The section on stone-throwing games includes a detailed description of a local variant where participants hurled rounded stones at a wooden target while balanced on one leg, a rule the author noted with some bewilderment as he could find no practical military application for the stance.
As right? The colonial administrator's confusion about the one-leg thing is doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
It really is. One thing we didn't touch on that I think is worth leaving listeners with, we're likely to see more ISPs move towards simplified architectures over the next few years. The pressure from municipal fiber and community broadband is real, and just plug in and it works is a hard user experience to compete with when you're requiring VLAN tags and PPP PoE credentials.
The VLAN tag might become a historical artifact, like the dial tone.
But until then, knowing how to configure it and why it exists is still essential for anyone who wants control over their own network edge. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping this show running.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. It helps other people find the show.
We'll be back with another prompt soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.